Good afternoon. So last time we talked all about makefiles, so this sort of way of automating the process of building programs. We learned that there's a bunch of commands we want to run to build a program with sort of multiple source files, and especially to build it in a way where if we change something, we don't have to recompile absolutely everything. So we looked at sort of this make tool, which automates that based on rules rewrite, where we indicate sort of what are we looking to create, from what files, what commands do we run to do that. And these rules have what we call a target, the file that would be generated or updated, a list of prerequisites, and one or more commands that the make will run when we ask it, please make sure this target is up to date. And it figures out whether to do that or not based on looking at modification times and whether files exist and so on. And it does this recursively, so if we have one target that depends on another, so like we have a program which needs O files, and the O files need C files and H files, it's going to recurse, so it's going to look at we ask for the program, it's going to look for the O files. It's going to say, okay, to make these O files, I need these C files. It's going to check all the way through that sort of chain of rules. We also talked a bit about sort of phony rules that we talked about these targets for building files. We can also have these as kind of commands that we kind of customize for our program. So for example, we might have make clean as a command to just clean up generated files to forcibly rebuild things. For example, after we change compilers, we want to rebuild everything so we don't have anything built with the old compiler. And there's a way we talked about marking these rules so it doesn't get confused if we accidentally open our text editor and make a file called clean. And that we don't want that to stop make clean from working. And we mentioned, when we talked about writing these rules, it seemed like we had a lot of redundancy, that I was typing, my compiler flags all the time. I was typing the names of my files multiple times. And we talked about ways of avoiding that, kind of two strategies. So make has these macros, kind of like variables, so we can set, what the name of our compiler is once and use that in several places. And then if we want to change compilers, we can change that one setting at the top of our file and it takes effect over everywhere we've used it. And we also can write rules, rather than writing a rule for each file we want to generate, we can write a rule that represents sort of all files that follow a certain pattern. So a common example is that we have object files we made from C files. We don't want to have to write down, here's the command I run to make an object file from a C file multiple times. Instead, we just write it down once and say, this applies for making any .o file from any .c file. And when we do that with the sort of special suffix or pattern rule syntax, make will use those rules whenever we ask for a .o file to be updated and so on. Some questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so I looked at how people seem to be doing on the quiz, so I'll go over some selected quiz questions. So on question one on the quiz, asked about, I've modified part of libutility.so, what do I need to rerun to make that take effect? And a big thing people missed is that they said, I'm going to have to make main.exe again in order to take this into account. But because this is a dynamically linked library, which is what .so is used for in Linux, it's loaded at runtime. So if we edit the .so file, such as by re-linking it, that's sufficient for main.exe to use the new .so file the next time we use it. And since in the example we didn't modify the .h file, we don't have to worry about the functions in that .so file being called differently or anything like that. So we shouldn't need to make any changes to the executable. Some questions? Okay. Okay, so next other thing that some people seem to miss on the quiz was with our example of producing a constants.h from a constants.csv, where we said in this scenario, we have some C program we've written that knows how to read a CSV file and make a .h file for our project, whatever, you know, however we want the constants in the .h file just generated from the CSV file, presumably because that makes editing them, you know, something we can do in Excel and then have it something we can include. And if we think of the rule to make constants.h, which is what the question 3 was asking about, we need constants.csv, and we need to make sure we have a working version of the program, constants.csvh. And a lot of people wanted to also have us make sure we had a CSV to constants.csvh.0, which would be what we use to sort of create that utility program. And, well, we don't actually need that to run the command. Now you might say, wait a moment. We do need to make that an O file at some point. That's true. But the way that's going to happen is we're going to need to have some sort of rule for taking the .o file and turning it into the executable. And that rule would be where we want to have the dependency on the .o file. You know, that rule's not going to work correctly if we don't have that dependency there anyway, so it must have it. And that means there's no reason to have the dependency on the constants.h rule. So we'll have a constants.h rule, which depends on the .csv file and the executable. And then we'll have a rule for the executable that depends on the .o file. And because make, when it's trying to figure out what to do, it's going to check recursively, you know, that rule for the executable is going to make sure that if we modify the C file or the O file, that it will, in fact, rebuild the executable to handle whatever changed about how we're doing this conversion process. Questions about that? Okay, and finally, the last question on the quiz asked about, we had these two make files, one where I took a shortcut and I said, I don't want to write a rule for every single file. I wrote a rule to make foo.exe from foo.c. And in this rule, I ran the same command, so I produced a .o file that the make just didn't know about. It just gets produced, but make doesn't actually check for it. And I had the other version where I had a separate rule for the .o file. And the question we asked is, if I set the modification times of these files, like, will these two make files do different things? And to figure that out, I just enumerated all the sort of combinations of modification times and figured out what happened. And how am I figuring out what happens? Well, for our foo.exe based from foo.c, I'm just saying if foo.exe is older than foo.c, we're going to rebuild it. And the process of rebuilding is also going to modify foo.o. If, in the other case, I look at these individual rules, if foo.exe is older than foo.o, we're going to rebuild it. But before we do that, we're going to check if foo.o is older than foo.c, and if so, rebuild foo.o first, and then move on to checking foo.exe. I just went through that for all these scenarios and figured out what happened and determined that, oh, the sort of simpler make file has cases where it won't act when the other one would. Questions? Logic for this? Okay. And briefly on history, some anonymous feedback. So one claiming, I miss people who raise their hands. I can believe it. I need to get used to looking in all the spaces in the room, which this room is very wide for some reason, and also very tall compared to what I'm used to teaching in. Hopefully I will do that. Also, please write more clearly. Yes, I should do that. And about the C review, wondering if I could go over memory allocation. I think people know that well enough that it wouldn't be worth my time. With respect to when do you allocate for the assignment, there's this big hint that we tell you what we expect running your code to be able to free. And if we can free it, it better have been allocated with malloc or realloc or something similar. So in the warm-up assignment, we say, oh, the thing you return, we need to be able to free that and all the things in the array it points to. So those are things you better allocate. As far as figuring out in general, sort of my general thought is, well, if I have a pointer, it has to point to something, and I better know why that's still in my memory. If I don't know why, probably I should allocate it so it is. That's sort of the way I would start, is that pointers need to point somewhere, and that memory, I better be able to explain why is that memory still there. And one way to make sure it's still there is to have created it with malloc, not freed it. Okay, so questions on anonymous feedback things. Okay, so we're going to go on to topic about how operating systems work and also about how hardware helps operating systems work. So to motivate this, I'm going to list some things that if you're writing on Portal, if you SSH into Portal, that's a machine that other students are also running programs on. There are things you expect that you should not be able to make a program do on Portal as just one student using it among many. So one thing is you shouldn't be able to read other students' files. Another is you shouldn't be able to modify the OS memory and like break how the machine works. Like you aren't authorized to upgrade or break or crash the OS, hopefully. You shouldn't be able to read other users' data. If I'm editing a text file in my text editor, your program shouldn't accidentally read that text or purposely read that text. Either way, it shouldn't happen. There shouldn't be that. And you shouldn't be able to hang the system, that no matter what you do, hopefully you can't accidentally write a while loop and suddenly no one can use Portal anymore. So these are all things that that we would say that it shouldn't be the case that you should be able to do with the program on Portal. And this kind of runs into a problem with kind of our model for what happens when you write and run a program. Because our model for that is that your program's instructions are executing on the processor, and there's nothing different about when your program's instructions are executing versus anyone else's, so far as we've learned. So we need something that's going to make that different. We're going to talk about what those mechanisms are. Why is it different when your instructions are executing versus someone else's? Because it seems like, oh, it's just machine code with register values. There's nothing that distinguishes your programs from anything else. And we'll start with the issue of reading other users' files. And this is something we're going to talk about, sort of the main hardware mechanism here that is going to, make it so your programs can read your files, but not other users' files. And, well, the problem is we want to implement hardware that does this. And let's say the files are stored in a hard drive. In Portal, it's a little more complicated than that, but let's say they're stored in a local hard drive. So we want you to somehow be able to have your programs communicate with the hard drive to get your files, but even though other user students' files are stored in the same hard drive, to not be able to get those students' files. So how could we do this? And I have kind of different ways we can implement this. So one idea is that when we start your program, the OS somehow tells the hardware, hey, for this program, these are the parts of the hard drive they can access. And we could have some hardware that figures out how to filter your accesses to the hard drive to implement this policy, that these are the parts we can access. This is something we could absolutely do, but it's really complicated. We have to figure out where are all your files. We have to have the hardware implementation of kind of filtering these requests, which makes our hard drives or some piece of hardware that's between our hard drives and our processor a lot more complicated. So this is not what we're going to do. It's something we could implement, but especially for restricting access to files, it's way too complicated. Another thing we could imagine doing is that before we run your program, we could try to verify that it only accesses files it's supposed to. That we could check its code and make sure that you aren't doing anything that would access files that aren't yours. This doesn't require our hardware to do anything special, but this is really hard to do, especially if you think of our programs just being a bunch of machine code from the compiler. We'd have to have some way of like figuring out what that machine code does. That's really hard, and you could, there are ways of making this approach practical, but it's not something any OS you're used to using does. So instead, we're going to kind of use a compromise solution, which is that the OS is going to arrange with the hardware to only allow code that the OS has written to talk to the hard drive. So we're still going to run your code, but we're going to run it in a way where your code is never going to talk to the hard drive. If it wants to talk to the hard drive, it has to run this OS written code that has been vetted by our OS maker to talk to the hard drive, and that code is going to enforce our restrictions. That, you know, that if it's running on behalf of you, it's only going to access your files, not anyone else's. So this is something which is a good compromise because it's relatively straightforward for the OS to implement. It's much simpler for the hardware to implement than the first strategy, but you know, something the hardware can help the OS with that makes is a lot simpler than the OS kind of checking what your code does. And it's actually not much extra work for our programs because we wouldn't actually talk to the hard drive directly generally. We'd call some function to do that. So the OS just writes those functions. And just needs to write them carefully to enforce whatever restrictions it wants to place on what we can do. And we're going to talk about what's the hardware to allow this to happen look like, and what does the interface for calling the SOS routines look like? So before I do that, questions about sort of this problem and the solution strategy. Okay, so what we're going to do to implement this strategy in our hardware is we're going to add an extra 1-bit register to our processor that I'm going to call the "Are we in kernel mode" register. And kernel mode is going to be a special name. And if we're not in kernel mode, we're going to say we're in user mode. And the hardware is going to check this register and only allow certain operations when we're in kernel mode. And the idea is that when we're running the OS code, we might be in kernel mode. When we're running normal code, we'll be in user mode instead. And those operations won't work. And among those operations, we'll be talking to the hard drive, and we could have a whole bunch of things that we kind of gate behind this 1-bit register. So questions about this kernel mode bit idea? So there's two problems we have in setting this up. So one is that we need some way of sort of setting up when we get in kernel mode or when we're not in kernel mode. So the first part of this is that when the system boots, we're going to start in kernel mode, so the OS can do all things that require these extra privileges. And before the OS runs your code, it's going to switch back to user mode, so your code can't do things it's not allowed to do. Now, we need some mechanism so the processor will switch back to to kernel mode when it runs the OS's code. And we'll talk about what that is a bit later. But we're going to need some special help from the hardware to make that happen. So what this is going to give us is that we'll have our programs, and our programs are running in user mode, so we're going to have our instructions that are running that are going to use the interface the hardware provides, like add, move, and so on. But that's going to be a more limited interface in terms of things like talking to hard drives and some other operations than a full hardware interface, because we're in user mode. And instead, when we want to access those sort of special operations, we're going to do what's called a system call. We're going to ask the operating system to do something for us by calling some operating system routine. And when we do that, we're going to run what's called the kernel, which is going to be the part of the OS that runs in kernel mode, the part of the OS that has these extra privileges to do operations like talk to the hard drive or anything else we don't want any program to just be able to do. So when we want the OS to do that for us, we're going to use this system call interface to call routines in the OS kernel, and the kernel will have access to the full hardware interface without any restrictions to implement those routines. So what does this system call interface look like? And one way you could imagine implementing this is that we'd have our program loaded, and we'd have the OS loaded, and we just tell the processor, here's where the OS is loaded. When I call those functions, just switch to kernel mode, because that's the OS's code. That doesn't quite work. And a reason that doesn't quite work is, let's think about how I'm going to implement my read files. I'm going to have maybe a function I can call to read a file. And that function is going to do a check, like, can you access the file? Great, that's a perfectly fine thing for me to call, and that's not going to allow my program to do anything it's not supposed to do. But if we think of how we implement this, probably I'm going to have a call the real implementation of reading from the disk. And that thing is just going to talk to the hard drive directly, and it's not going to redo the check of whether the current program can access the file. And generally, it would be really hard to write an operating system such that I could just call anywhere in the OS's code and have it do something that's not going to be something I want to disallow. So we're not going to allow user programs to just call any function in the OS, in the kernel that runs in kernel mode. We're going to only allow them to call specific ones. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to have a special instruction that the hardware is going to provide to enter kernel mode and run an OS routine, which we'll call a system call. And rather than just running any old function in the kernel, this is going to run just one function. And the OS is going to specify where that function is at boot. So as part of booting, before it starts your program, it's going to say, here's where I want system calls to run. And that's the only place you're going to be able to go. So that code's going to make sure it enforces all the checks, like, can you actually access this file before it goes on? And you can't bypass it by just jumping past that, because you can only call the specific, hopefully very carefully checked part of the OS. And the code that this jumps to is going to sort of have two jobs. So one job is that because this is going to be the place we go to for all the system calls, this is going to need to figure out what the program wants to do, because I might want to read from a file, I might want to write to the screen, I might want to send something on the network. There's a whole bunch of things that the program might be asking the OS to do that all have to use this single function. And also, we need to be very careful to enforce that no matter how the program calls this, that it's not going to do anything bad. That I shouldn't be able to read someone else's file by, providing funny parameters to this. That shouldn't be possible. So as a concrete example, let's look at how this looks from the side of making a system call on Linux in 64-bit x86. So the special instruction in x86 assembly is syscall. And like with function calls, the Linux operating system defines a calling convention for system calls, one that probably looks almost the same to you as you hopefully remember normal function calls looking. The only real difference is that rather than knowing what operation we're doing based on which function we called, we have to have some other way of knowing that. And what Linux has chosen to do is that you set the RAX register to indicate which function to run, rather than specifying that through which function you call, because there's only system call or no system call. And otherwise, it's basically the same as a normal function call. You pass arguments through registers, You get a return value through a register, and so on. Questions? This setup. So here's a little function program that prints hello world without using the C library. So no printf, nothing like that. Just directly make system calls to do that. So we make the system call to write to the screen. That's not something any program can just do. The kernel coordinates how that's done. So to do that, I specify what operation I want to do by setting RAX. And in this case, I set it to 1. 1 happens to be the constant Linux chose for the write operation. And then I specify my arguments. In this case, my argument is, where do I want to write to? 1 is the number for standard out. It's just chosen by the Linux developers. And then I specify what I want to write. In this case, I pass a pointer to this string as the next argument and the length of that string. And then I run the syscall instruction, and that's going to kind of like a function call. It's going to run this OS code. The OS code's going to check RAX, find out, oh, you want to write? Let me see if that's okay. Yep, you can write to standard out. That's fine. Let me copy your hello world to the terminal. And then after that, it returns from the system call, and I do this next system call here, where I choose operation 60, which is the number for the exit operation. Why is that a system call? Well, what does exit do? It stops writing our program and runs something else. That's not something I can just do. I need the OS to help me with that. I can't do things with other programs. That requires kernel mode access, so I'm going to ask the OS for help by making another system call requesting the exit operation. Okay. Questions? Here, yes.
So why did you store the link into RDX? Does the syscall require the length of the string to pass?
Question, why does the system call require me to provide the length of a string as an argument? And the answer is that this system call is designed for writing arbitrary bytes, not just strings. So I need to provide the length in bytes because it supports, for example, writing a bunch of null characters to a file. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Why do you have underscore start instead of main?
Question, why do I have underscore start instead of main? So the way the C library works is that stuff has to run before your main starts. So for example, to make printf work, we want some code to run before main starts. And also to get the argument set up for main, we want some code to run to, you know, make sure argc and argv are all set up. And the way that's implemented on Linux is that your program does not actually start executing with main, it starts executing with a function that the compiler provides that eventually calls main. In this case, I don't have a C library, so I don't have that code here, so I'm writing that code myself, so I write my own sort of actual start routine. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, follow up on that. So I only put this code in and tried to assemble it, and it said there was a conflicting definition between the starts. So are we just like, is this kind of example
where we don't have that? So your question is, when I tried to link this program, I got an error that someone else has defined start. So what's probably happening there is the C library that you're still linking to defines start. In order to link this program, you need to not link with the C library, which is possible to do by passing an option to clang or GCC. Because this is a program that doesn't want the C library. Yes? The question is, how does syscall prevent just any user from messing with the kernel? So when the syscall function, syscall instruction runs, the hardware is going to switch to kernel mode, but it's going to run code at a location the OS specified. And I have sort of a hypothetical example of what might be there, but it's going to do something where it just calls one of a list of functions, and if you don't have something, and that's the only things you can do. So if there's not an operation that they've decided to provide, you're not gonna be able to do it with the syscall operation, and that's how we keep you from doing things that aren't allowed. Another part of it is that the operations they do allow, like say opening a file, they're always going to check, are you really allowed to do this? They're not just gonna open the file for you. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And as I alluded to there, a typical way this kind of might be implemented in the OS's code is that the OS will tell the processor, go to this handle syscall function, and that function will do something like look up in a table using RAX which operation to do from a list of types of system calls it allows. And if you're out of bounds of that table, we'll just say, nope, can't do it, and go back, or crash your program. Other questions? Yeah.
So, like, I guess when you design the functions that you allow people to do, you have to be really smart about, like, not letting people do something that,
so the question is, when you design the functions that you allow syscalls to do, you have to be careful about making sure that they can't be abused. Yes. And this is, in fact, is tricky in practice because sort of a big OS like Linux will have, you know, several hundred possible values of RAX. And some of them can do multiple things, like files on different types of devices and so on. But the hope is that, you know, everyone who's designing a new operation will be careful about, is this okay for everyone to call any time? You know, does it always at least, you know, only do safe things or fail, basically? Yeah. So the question is, you don't need to set permissions for individual system calls. Every program can use every system call. They just don't do anything dangerous. Yes. So for example, there's going to be a system call to shut down the perp system. But that the implementation of that is going to have, like, if you are administrator, shut down the system, else return an error. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Could you maybe make some comment about, like, using RAX, because instead of hundreds of system call numbers, you can have theoretically billions. But I believe it was originally placed in RAX when you still have like 2^64 possible system call numbers.
So the question is, given how big RAX is, do we have billions of possible system calls? So one of the things that the code I'm not showing here is gonna do is it's gonna check, you know, if RAX is too big. And the size limiting is just gonna be how many system calls have we come up with so far. And typically, so on Linux, that's 300, 400 or 500 something, I think. I think I've heard Windows is like a couple thousand, maybe. At least like old Windows, I'm not sure, but it's not. It's not millions, it's typically at most thousands. And in some more elegant OSs, maybe like, you know, tens. So in this example, I showed two system calls, write and exit. So Linux has a whole bunch of them. So like there's system calls for allocating memory, there's system calls for making a new process, for running different programs, for accessing files, open, read, and write, for creating sockets to talk on the network, connecting them, and so on. So their system calls for lots of different types of operations. And all of these are kind of things that we can't allow programs to do directly. So like we can't allow you to allocate memory directly because we need to make sure that you aren't interfering with other programs' use of memory. We can't allow you to create new processes directly because the OS has to track what programs are running and know that. We can't allow you to access files directly because we need to check, can you access this file? Are you allowed to do that? And so on. And we can't allow you to talk on the network directly because we want you to make sure that you aren't interfering with other programs trying to use the network. So, given given what you've seen here, it looks like in order to use system calls, I need to write assembly. Now, in practice, you'll often hear people talking about C program, talking about making a system call in their C code. And they're not going to be doing it by making inline assembly that uses the syscall instruction or similar. Typically, they'll just be calling a function, say it's a system call. So it's not a system call, but typically what it is what I'll call a system call wrapper. So the standard library on Linux and many other systems has functions whose sole purpose is to make a system call. So for example, there's an open function on Linux, which what it does is it sets RAX to be the number for open and runs the syscall instruction. And then it runs some other code to like get you returned on. So this is not, so if you call the open function, that's not literally a system call, but that's all the open function does. So often colloquially we'll say, oh, the open function's a system call, even though it's really a very thin wrapper around a system call. It's a function that only makes a system call. And you might see this used in sort of C code like so. Like this is how the sort of lowest level way in C on Linux for opening a file. I can say open input.txt read only. And this function called open is calling this code where, you know, it's going to, shortly after I call that function, it's just going to make a system call. The function doesn't do any other work. And the kernel is going to handle figuring out what input.txt is and so on. Some questions? Yes. And you can see I have some error handling code where I like figure out what error happened and so on, but which would be useful when you're doing assignments. We're not going to talk about it too much today, but I want you to be aware that that's a thing that's kind of conventional with system calls on Linux, is that they'll return a special number in the case of an error, and they'll set this special error node to tell you what went wrong. Okay. So one thing, if you want to explore system calls in Linux, there's similar utilities in other systems. There's this program called strace, which is like a debugger that sort of traces all the system calls a program makes. So if I run it on the program we showed you earlier that was written in assembly, I can get this trace text file, and it shows me that when I ran this, first we ran this execve system call to invoke the hello world program, and then it made a write system call and then a exit system call. And strace figured out what the arguments are. It's basically sort of an automated doing the debugger stepping thing and then reading the arguments and printing them out. Like you could do by hand in the debugger if you really wanted, but obviously this is a lot less tedious. I can also run this on kind of our more conventional Hello World program. And we can see a lot of extra things happen when we're using the C library. We have these functions related to memory allocation running. We have this thing where the C library is setting up to use potentially multiple threads. It's like checking what's the name of our program, what system am I running on. It's checking system settings in a configuration file. It's checking, are we outputting to a terminal or a normal file? And then it does the actual write, same write we saw before. So you can see that there's actually lots of things that our programs are asking for help all the time with these system calls. It's not, we can check that. And I can also see, if I run a dynamically linked version of this program, I can see some other things going on, like the program opening up the C library to load it into its memory. So it does that using a system call because it can't load the C library. It can jump to the code after it loads it, but it has to copy it from this. Needs help to do that. questions about system calls? So, seeing that when we write these typical programs here, I'm using like puts and other functions. So, the way we write typical programs, you know, this diagram doesn't quite work for that. I have my applications, you know, and I call things like puts, which aren't system calls. They're things that are implemented using system calls and, you know, other things like that. So the way I think about it is that typically what actually happens is that we write our programs. They use some instructions in the hardware directly, like move, add, and so on. And they also use this library that's implemented in turn using the system call interface. In some cases, the implementation's really trivial. Like we show that open function where I call open in the library, and all it does is make a system call. In some cases, it's more complicated, like what we saw with what happens when I, you know, start up my program, all this sort of checking of what, you know, where does the standard out go, loading files, and so on. But in either case, we're kind of programming against these libraries that use system calls and sort of the simple calculation capabilities and data storage movement capabilities of the hardware assembly instructions. So questions? Yes. Can I go over the difference between the library interface and the system libraries? Okay, so in this diagram, the application system libraries, kernel, and hardware are things, and the gray represents interfaces between them. So the system libraries are a thing which provides an interface, which I call the library interface, so this is function calls like open, puts, printf, and so on. And the system call interface, that's what we can do with the syscall instruction, you know, what capabilities that has, and that's implemented by the kernel. Other questions? Okay, so we had two other things we talked about not being able to do on Portal, which is modify OS memory, read other users' data in memory. And for this, the system call idea doesn't work because it seems like this interface that we can act to directly, that should include things like a move instruction. We don't have to make a system call to move between a register and memory. And you know that because you've written assembly. You didn't write the syscall instruction to do that. You just wrote a move or a push or a pop. So a question about sort of your intuition for how things should work on a shared system. So let's say on Portal, I have these two programs. And I have one program where I have a global variable located at address 10000, which has the value 42. And I have another program which is going to try to write to that same address the value 99. And I'm just running these at the same time. So first question, in A, when I read from that global variable, what am I going to get? What should I get? Based on how you think things should work, you know, if you write this program and run it on Portal. You have time to think about that. question?
Are these programs different processes?
We'll get to that later. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks it should be A? That we should get 42 in program A as the value that goes into Rx. B, we should get 99. C, we should get the address we were trying to read from. D, we could get either 42 or 99. It depends on like timing or exactly how these are laid out in memory. Who thinks we could get either of those values or the program might crash? We just may have a crash from program A, you people. And something else should happen? People, no clue? Okay, bunch of no clues. So let's say only program A was running. In that case, well, we're reading from address 10000. We know initially 42 is there. Assuming none of the code in the do work section modifies that, it should still be 42. So that would be the behavior if only program A was running. So the question is, what does program B do to that? And assuming these are separate programs, so like things we run separately from our command line, we would expect them to kind of behave separately. At least we expect this in some cases. So like if I log into the machine and run program A, and you log in and run program B, we would hope that you don't break my program A. Because you know, in this example, I'm using this address, but this might be just a global variables at that address. We'd hope that wouldn't break. And in fact, what will happen on a system like Portal is that we're going to ensure that as long as these are actually two separate programs, that what program B does is not going to affect program A. That program A's variables, it's not going to matter that program B tried to access the same address, that's not going to do anything to program A. And this is kind of good, because you've probably written code that said faults. And when you write code that said faults, you're probably doing something where you're accessing an address, and maybe some other program's using that address. It's pretty good that it doesn't do anything bad. And also, if we think of the memory for these programs, often the memory the OS will provide for the two programs will have stuff at the same address in two different programs. So like we're running program A and program B, and often if we look at what addresses they have, they'll have code loaded at the same address that's different in the two programs because they're two different programs. Might say, well, wait, don't we need to load that code at two? If these programs are running at the same time, don't we need to have the programs loaded in different places? Well, it turns out with modern hardware, we have hardware support, so the OS doesn't have to do that. That we can lay out program A such that its code starts at exactly the same place as program B. You might say, wait a moment, but isn't there only one thing in that place in memory? Well, the way this works, we alluded to it in the first lecture, is that the programs don't actually access the memory directly. There's going to be some indirection. And the way that's going to work is that when program A is running, it's going to go through a mapping the OS sets. When program B is running, they're going to go through a mapping the OS sets. And this means that when program A uses address 10,000 here, it's going to end up going through this mapping and presumably ending up somewhere in its data region after we do the mapping. And if program B uses the same number, the same address, it has a different mapping. And the OS is most likely going to set things up so that when program B goes through here, either its mapping goes to something that says it's an error and the program sent false, or maybe its mapping goes through and goes to program B's data, which is perfectly fine, but it's not going to interfere with program A's because it's actually different storage. Yes?
Is there a way that programs can interact with real memory without going through mapping?
So the question is, there a way the programs could interact with the real memory without going through the mapping? On most sort of desktop or mobile phone OSs, no. There are some very simple OSs for very usually very simple devices which don't have that restriction, but not on typical OSs you have used. Yeah?
So each time you load a new program, the OS spins up a new mapping for that program?
So question, each time I load a new program, the OS spins up a new mapping? Yes. Other questions? Yeah.
So, depending on how many programs you have running, if you close one, does that mapping become available for another program?
So the question is, depending on how many programs I'm running, if I close one, does that make more mappings available? So we haven't talked about what format these mappings actually take. We'll do that in a lot more detail when we talk about virtual memory, which is how these mappings are implemented. The summary is that these mappings are stored in memory, so as long as we have more memory available, the OS can create as many mappings as it likes. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
What if program A and B use the same variables? What if B uses something
from A? So the question is, what if A and B are supposed to share data? That is something that they can arrange. How would they arrange that? They would make a system call asking the OS, please update the mapping so we both point to the same place. And that is in fact something you can do and something you will do on the Signals lab in a couple weeks. Yes, back there.
What if data
Sorry, what if data is split at the boundaries of the mappings? So we'll talk more about the format of the mappings later. There are some restrictions on what the mappings can have, and the way OSs deal with that generally is by wasting space. Other questions? Yeah. Question, when program A or B starts, is it allocated its memory or pretend that it have it? We'll talk about that more when we talk about virtual memory. We have to allocate something for the program to start executing though, which presumably whatever system call we make to say start a new program will do at least that. Does that answer your question? Question is, when does this mapping get executed? When does the translation of 1000 to a real address happen? It's something the processor does during every single instruction. So you might be legitimately concerned, gosh, isn't this really slow? That when I run a move instruction that moves a value from memory to somewhere, I in fact need to go through this mapping twice, once to get the address of the code for the machine code for that instruction, and again to get the address of the data. isn't that really slow? That's a good concern. We'll talk about how processors make that efficient later in the semester. It is not trivial. So this is a case where what system calls, like what the processor is doing, is pretty simple. Here, what the processor is doing is actually a lot of work, takes up a lot of space in the hardware, but it's what they do to support having programs that use memory in kind of arbitrary ways. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and we alluded to having this idea that the mapping can say, specify that locations trigger an error, and what will this typically happen for? Well, if we look at our program's layout, there's all this space that you can't access, that you would think of as, if I try to do that, it causes a seg fault. So that in the mapping kind of maps to this trigger error region. So we'll talk about what does it actually mean to trigger an error, and it's going to be very related to system calls. For that, just some things people have gotten to. So we'll talk about what the mapping looks like when we talk about virtual memory. The actual name of the thing that most current systems use to implement this mapping is called page tables. There are other ways of doing it that are that have been used that are less flexible but a lot simpler in the hardware. Page tables, which are the most common way today, are relatively complicated, which is why we're going to spend several lectures on them and a big assignment. Also, someone asked, oh, could they share data? Absolutely. So we could have the OS set up the mapping so they have some shared data or code. And we'll have an assignment where you request this on Linux. You can do this by opening a file or a special file and using this mmap routine to ask for that file to be in your memory. If two programs do that, they'll have the same memory. So that's how you request that on Linux. Okay, so I promised I'd talk about this trigger error. So we know for program B, you know, if program B might trigger an error when it tries to access that location that it didn't allocate any memory on. That's a possibility. And if we think of what happens, like we display a crash message and run some other program. This sounds like the kind of operation that like needs a system call, right? The program doesn't have any code to actually like run another program. And the hardware needs to somehow make this happen. And the hardware doesn't know how to like run another program or display the message segmentation fault or anything like that. So the hardware is not going to actually implement that itself. Instead, what it's going to do is it's going to ask the OS for help. So the hardware, when this program accesses this out-of-bounds memory, is going to run a designated OS routine. So this should sound very much like system calls, that in order to do something, we are just going to call a specific routine that the OS set up. In this case, the something we want to do is not do an operation on behalf of a program. In this case, it's handle an error. But the mechanism, as far as what the hardware is doing, is basically exactly the same. The hardware is calling a function in the OS at a location the OS told the hardware about at boot. So at boot, the hardware is going to say, here's where you go when the program accesses crazy memory addresses. And the hardware will just call that function when that happens. And this kind of general idea of having the hardware call the OS when it needs help is called exceptions. So it's going to have different triggers than your system calls, but the mechanism for all these exceptions, which is going to include system calls and these things that you know as segmentation faults, some other things we'll talk about, is all going to be the same. We're going to switch to kernel mode and run a routine the OS specified at boot. And on a typical system, how will the OS specify that? Is that they'll have a table in memory of here are all my routines for handling special things you might want me to do. It will set a special register that only can be set in kernel mode to say where these routines are. And I'll just have a list of the functions for handling each type of event that might happen. So we'll have one of these will be handle system call. One of these will be handle segfault. And we'll just have all these routines sort of set up for the hardware defined at boot. And then when we're running programs, the hardware just checks this table when it needs to figure out how do I run the OS to handle whatever just happened. And we'll talk about some of these other things later. So far, we've seen kind of two types of exceptions. We have system calls. So these are cases which where intentionally the program triggers an exception because it wants the OS to do something for it. And we've talked about errors in programs. So we talked about you're accessing memory that you don't have access to. We'll also use the same mechanism to handle what if a program like tries to talk to the hard drive directly. That's going to trigger an exception. We're going to tell the OS is going to run a routine in the OS. The OS can decide, what do I do about this program that tried to access the hard drive without making a system call? Probably it's going to crash it, but maybe it could do something else at once. And even just for crashing it, the hardware doesn't know how to crash a program. The OS has to do that, because crashing a program is like displaying a message, running a different program. That's too complicated for the hardware to know how to handle. Other things you might have done, like dividing by zero, that will trigger an exception. So the OS can display the divide by zero message, or running an illegal instruction, and so on. And the exceptions we've talked about so far are what we'll call synchronous. So as a preview of the other type, there will be asynchronous ones. Synchronous means that these are things that are triggered by whatever code we were running. So we're running some code, the hardware doesn't know how to deal with what the code wants to do or needs to do, so it runs the OS to figure out what to do. Questions? So I have these synchronous exceptions, but there's one thing on my original list that this synchronous exception won't handle, and that's another thing our program should be able to do, which is hang the whole system. And a reason why that's not able to handle is, let's think about this program here. If I think of what this program compiles to, this is going to be like main, jump main. There's nothing this program is doing that is asking for the OS's help. There's nothing that's failing. Like, we can jump back to main. That's perfectly fine. But if we just let this run, then we just hang an entire core. And if we only had one core, we'd hang the entire system. Or if we had multiple cores, we could run, you know, one copy for each core, hang the entire system. And that definitely shouldn't be possible. So what in fact happens is that, well, this doesn't work. If you try to run this on Portal, it's not going to hang the whole system. So what's happening? Well, one way we can find out is we can run a variant of it where we just time how long it takes to do a comment. So nothing. And here I have a plot of those timings on a log scale. And we can see I have some very suspicious timings where sometimes, you know, typically it takes tens of nanoseconds to do between those two get time operations, which is probably just how long it takes to get the time. But sometimes it takes like milliseconds or many microseconds, so much, much slower. So what was going on when this happened? Well, probably the OS decided I had enough of you and ran something else. But it needed some help to do that because I didn't write any instructions to run the OS. Somehow the OS got to run and do something else. And to make this happen, we have kind of these externally triggered exceptions. And one type of them that's very common is we'll have timer interrupts. So these are exceptions that are triggered by a timer that the OS sets up before it runs your program. So to keep you from hanging the system, before the OS jumps to your code, it will start a timer that will go off and say 10 milliseconds. And when that timer goes off, the hardware will call an OS function, and that OS function can say, yep, you've been running too long, let's run something else. There also will be these exceptions for things like I/O. So if I press a key, we want that to be handled for whatever program it's for. And the way the hardware will do that is we'll call an OS routine. The OS routine can figure out, oh, this is a key press. Do I want to switch to a program for that? And maybe it will do that. Or maybe we'll just look at the key press and keep running the current program. Gets to decide. And we'll also have these exceptions for really exceptional situations, like if the hardware detects something's broken, it can run the OS to like display an error or maybe work around it somehow or something. Yes? So the question is, am I saying that when the OS is busy, the time for nothing is longer? Well, I'm saying that the OS gets to run in the middle of my nothing. So from my point of view, what I'm doing is I'm getting the current time that I'm getting the current time. And when I do that, sometimes there's this huge delay. And what's really happening is the OS is running in that delay from one of these exceptions, like a key press or a timer going off, and it's deciding to spend a million cycles doing something else. Why it did that, we don't know, but it decided to do that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will it always come back, like the increment to the program, or will it eventually like terminate?
So the question, will it always come back or eventually terminate? So that's up to the OS's code to decide how to handle that. So what the OS usually does with our like infinite loop is it uses this exception mechanism to do what's called time multiplexing. So even if we have one core, my loop program, I'm showing time here, it gets to run some of the time. And in the gaps, the OS could, if it wants, run other programs or do other things. And the way this is implemented is that we have these exceptions occur that typically are, you know, that can be triggered by system calls or triggered by external events like key presses or timers. The OS runs and it makes a decision about what to do. And in this example, it decided to run some other programs, then switch back to the loop program. The OS could decide not to switch back. It's just code the OS author wrote and chose what policies to use. Question, that answer your question? Other question there? Yeah.
So does it do this exception checking specifically for timer stuff?
So the question is, when does this exception checking happen? So this is exceptions are a thing the hardware does. So when certain events happen, the hardware notices and calls the OS. And the hardware therefore is checking, is the timer expired? The hardware is checking, did a key press happen, and so on. So the hardware is doing those checks as it's running normal instructions. Does that answer your question? So yes, there's something to checking. It's not the OS that's checking for exceptions all the time. The hardware is doing that. Does that answer your question?
I just could it run these checks stuff?
So the question is, can the exceptions interrupt any program? Yes. If I'm unlucky enough that the key press gets received during my program, that's when the exception handler for it will run. If you really need nothing to interrupt your program, you better have some help from the OS to change how exceptions are being handled by the OS. Yeah?
How does time multiplexing work with multi-threaded programs?
Question, how does this work with multiple threads? So with multiple threads on a single core, we can switch between two threads from the same program, which we'll talk about when we talk about threads later. With multiple cores, we're going to be doing this kind of switching on every core. And you know, if we have more cores, probably we need to switch less often, but we still will do it, especially since we often have many more programs than cores, or threads than cores. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Question, what if an exception happens while another exception is being handled? There's two ways we can deal with that. Do I have my slides for that? Yes. So That could be a problem. So the most common mechanism to help OSs deal with that is that there's typically a way of disabling exceptions from being delivered temporarily while you're handling one. This is not something we'll test on, but I do have slides because I've taught more advanced courses on this. That's on. Any other questions before I'm finishing up? Okay, so next time we'll talk a little more about how this multiplexing works, like how do we switch between programs, and we'll go on to talking about some exception-related things that Linux provides called syncs.